All right, we're going to start the last part, which is always my favorite part. Using common sense to comes tonight, but not real long. Don't make it like crazy time. And let's have some fun out here. And if you feel compelled to even read your third, it's the grand finale. Nobody's going to get angry at you, except Joe. She got an award, so it doesn't matter. Okay. All right. She's my girl.
Hello. Doesn't sound like it that any of you guys could ever be depressed. but more than likely, several of you, if not many of you, experience depression. I don't feel like it right now, but I do get depressed pretty badly from time to time. So my work reflects that. So a couple of not very funny poems. This is, I need no winter's wind. I need no winter's wind to chill these bones. This heart now iced with darkened thoughts. Will sunshine melt a frozen soul, my icy hell, this polar ache? No. In spring and summer, still deep black snow obscures all hope. What kind of coat, what kind of hat can I sew to save myself? With no tools nor strength enough to cut the cloth, stitch the seams, to laugh, to play, be calm of mind. I do not know. I'm too cold. This one's not a whole lot happier. I do know some jokes, but not now. Excuse me. This is called Bombs Drop All Around Me. I drag myself to the psychiatric clinic. As usual, my doctor opens with, what did you do this week and how are you? I answer, nothing. Dreadful. But what I meant to say, about me are shredded thoughts, littered with trips, traps, hazards to evade, staggered moods that fall down craters, craws, downcast, cast down. My maimed mind avalanched by repetition, entrapped at the bottom. I struggle up, slide down, climb up again and again, then crawl out. Finally free? Futile. Instead, I say, bombs drop all around me. Thank you.
Good poetry, my man. If you want to get over your depression, loosen your suspenders a little. Okay. There you go. There you go, baby. You got it all. All right, Greg Bell, where you at? I know you're hiding someplace. There you go, my man. Come on.
That's fine, thanks. Well, greetings, poets of Pittsburgh. I come to you from sunny Southern California, land of the fruits and nuts. I want to take a moment to thank Joan Bauer for inviting me here. We've shared the Wednesday night workshop at Beyond Baroque. And she attended the reading of my new book here, Looking for Will, My Bardic Quest with Shakespeare. I don't know if you know this. I discovered this in my trajectory, but I found that there have been more words written by and about Shakespeare than on any other subject but the Bible. So you got to be some kind of crazy to take on researching and writing a one-man play as William Shakespeare. And I guess I was just crazy enough to do it. Here is poem number one. Leaving England after having done a good deal of research. New old bread. From pleasant plucking of the lute, soft harmony from catgut. Archaeologist of the invisible, echoing down the eidolons of history through the longing over home and hearth of another when and where. I am resonating still in fire and air, in blood and stone, with treasure-troved ephemera, and in the threatened waters of the Shakespeared Isle, whose turning tawny calls me back to otherwhere, I am returning now to golden California to stitch the past in present time, to bake new bread in hearth and home on gridlocked battlefields where I must knock the arrow, draw, and find the target churning in my heart. Thank you. Poem number two. There came a time when I realized there was no retreat. I had to go through with it. Invocation. In expectant hush, the priest ascends the steps, brandishes the knife to initiate the ceremony. The dithyramb begins song of sacrifice. Then in the glint of focused light, down comes the sacred blade. And in blood, the price of pain is paid. The ritual fulfilled, call forth the deity, bring forth sweet will, the honey-tongued, poor will, mad will, all-embracing will, will by poseurs now usurped. And with this sacrifice, let will return to man to shake the spear at ignorance. Non sans drat, still, says he, and echoes through the centuries. Thank you.
That was some really good stuff. You remind me of an actor. Now, if you get depressed, take off the Ho Chi Minh. That'll do it, I'm telling you, every time. Good poet, man. Did you go to acting school and stuff like that? You seem like you would have been an actor. Great, great stuff, man.
I'm a recovering actor.
Well, good, man. You did a good job at it. What part of California are you from?
Sorry?
What part of California?
L.A.
L.A.? My daughter's down in Temecula. You know where that's at?
I do.
Aha, uh-huh. See that? Okay. I see them over there. All right. Let's see we have here. Help me out. John Slub. Okay, thank you. John, come on. My eyes are going. Not your fault, John. My fault.
I think I've got two poems here. First one is entitled Lunch Poem for Pete Lochner, who died young. He wanted to bang out lines of poetry on an old typewriter every day at lunchtime, like Frank, for as long as he could, aiming for 57 days to beat Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak. We were talking at the scene's old offices. I forget now what street, but it started to rain. Wind barreled in. There were many waves as the lake clouded over, signifying something. I never saw him again, but I didn't know it. On the way back, I passed Municipal Stadium in the wipers, adrift like an abandoned ship, where Ken Keltner and the Indians took hits away from 70,000 fans, July 17th, 1941. Zero hour. The dark night, deep as a first baseman's mitt, raiding the end of Joe's hot tunnel. The stands, now a decrepit saloon with song and dance men. That's Cleveland for you. Some guys stay lucky forever and some don't. I won't bore you with details. My poetry failed. Peter started a band that shook the world. Frank died on Fire Island, and Joe kept sending flowers to Marilyn's grave. I remember a line from high school Latin. Multae gloriae cupidate fecit. He did many things on account of his love of glory. In other words, streaks mean nothing, defying probability, that's all, like cowboys riding around a herd. It began in May, it ended in July, so what? The Germans parachuted into Crete and changed everything. Name, rank, regiment, number. And anyway, my dad was a Yankee hater, and that's how we were raised. One thing, though, during DiMaggio's 56-game hitting jag, with infielders sitting back in the outfield grass like farmers, Joe never bunted, never took the easy swing for glory. Pete neither. Requiescat in pace. This last one I want to read here again, called How Tuesday Began. There is a Marine sniper, young and tan. He wears a copper vest of a sun, with his shirt off, muscles of water, tattoos, and a short haircut. Now back in the USA, and he means business. Reading dawn's fine print from the front seat of a 71 Lincoln with New Mexico plates, pulled over on a tree lawn in Cleveland Heights, unloading bricks of wrapped marijuana far from jungle thorns and the rice-filled Mekong. I suppose his eyesight is fantastic. It is a warm December, and I can hardly see the bare tree branches penciled into a feathery sky. So many bark stalks after snow melts, when the wind blows off Lake Erie, they rub together with the sound of men stropping razors. Already the Marine and his friends have acquired a stolen gun collection spread out on our kitchen table next to a table hockey game. A Remington 700, an M40A1 bolt-action rifle, a Mauser C96 semi-automatic, and some others. I worry that after heavy drinking, the table hockey will become violent, because we are drinking a lot now and smoking a lot and forgetting a lot. This morning he said to me, there was a section of Vietnam countryside with cold, bubbling water in high lakes near a Buddhist monastery where his company patrolled an old rubber plantation. In the air, the smell of sawmill smoke and candles. He lay down for a minute and slept in the shade with his gun, his helmet, his equipment on a bed of green fern shoots, and dreamed of returning home and stealing and selling drugs, because he said some men have to pay for high lakes and deep water the color of tar and be judged in the sky's gun sight or move many miles beyond. Like the smoothest bullet cutting the greenest grass, like the smoothest skin of a whore, he said. And that's how Tuesday began, Christmas Day, 1973.
Thanks for staying. We're the diehards. Okay, so this is called Aries Pisces. You live near the tracks where your brother was killed. The house shakes every other hour. I wake up in your favorite denim shirt. Small town windows left open to Labor Day rain. A heap of bills on your desk, nude sketches of your ex, a postcard never sent, Monday again. I finger through your books, Blake on the nightstand, Burrows on the floor, I'm slow to adjust to the dull pulp of noon. I consider doing your dishes, making coffee, leaving my number on the fridge. Instead, I check my horoscope in one of her old magazines. Today, you have a heart as big as the universe, rating 7. Last night, you held my hand, said I could stay as long as I wanted. Shower, find out if I belong on your shelves, play, pretend. But I get dressed, leave the bed unmade. Thank you. Okay, this is called A Different Kind of Alone. I'm out of cash at the Pittsburgh airport, Friday night, waiting for you by baggage claim, picking raisins out of an old trail mix I found in the car, remembering I wanted to preserve my fresh breath after not seeing you for weeks. Hell with that. Your flight was delayed 2 hours, but I'm here already starving. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what helped get rid of my depression, if Jimmy Svedek ever can pronounce my name right. Someday. This poem's called The Continuum Hypothesis. Aleph Omega. When you told me one infinity can be greater than another, I didn't understand that. The living can never apologize to the dead. I didn't understand that there are roads we know the ends to and roads for which we do not. Aleph not. When you bought the book, Aleph won, penned by one of Hemingway's many children, intent on turning his legacy into actionable cash, Aleph too, you were thinking of me. You were thinking of how much I would enjoy a book about my favorite authors and their corresponding libations. You made the mistake of telling me, only to have me refute with pedagogic authority that Hunter S. Thompson's favorite drink was not Chivas Regal, and that not only was this an editorial oversight on her part, but a character flaw of yours. Left three. It didn't hurt that much when you returned the book that I would never receive. It didn't hurt that much when you hung up on the phone without saying I love you. And it didn't hurt that much when you left me, because I knew I was right. I knew that you loved me, and I knew that you would always exist, a breath, a phone call, away. Two to the left not equals a left one. Things are as you wanted. Your brother is back in school. Walls continue upright into Joyce out of view. All your secrets are your own. Your birthday is still August 2nd, and history retains a certain symmetry without you. I never told anyone. I lost the books Kate gave away at your service, in the back seat of a cab in Greenpoint. The infinite is, as Kate said, a hole so deep we don't know when, if ever, we will get out. This next one is called Memories of Childhood Sexual Abuse. I remember Eddie Lara, not for the tragedy he suffered, but for the tragedy he became. Thank you.
David, it's not that I mispronounced your name. It's like my overbite. When I was a kid, they used to call it buck teeth, and then they called it overbite. So with that, is my explanation. Okay. All right. Oh, I mean, do you know what you're going to do? It's like the R word. You're not allowed to say it anymore. All right. Pete Webb. Hey, well, look, give me the eraser. He's out of here. Ron Steiner. Ron? Come on, Ron. Okay.
right, I have one long poem. This is Hollow Shoes, Part 5.
Two pages.
Yeah, this is a long poem. This is 2 pages. Albert the Dreamer awoke beside feminine beauty, Sarah the Blade, still unconscious in her silent cocoon. The sunlight blazed through kitchen windows, floating out from quick-moving clouds. Mountain explosions awoke the other inhabitants of the mountain shack. Albert the Dreamer congregated friends together, as in war we will skirt the mountain roads our fathers paved, and see the spring flood fill the rivers once more. They packed the car with cases of beer and hiking equipment, the warm morning air wrapped around their naked legs below cut-off jeans. Like a hyena, Danielle the cartoon whooped at the morning activities, her long straight hair twisted into ponytail. Mikey the Foot walked around the rusted car, kicking the black tires as though each kick produced a spell to which never a tire would go flat again. Whew, a lot of sweat here. Sarah the Blade, Carlos of the Mountaintop, Mikey the Foot tossed bread and cheese into the cooler along with more beer. Albert the Dreamer sat behind the wheel when the cell phone rang. No one moved. It rang again, putting Sarah the Blade into a motion of discovery. Everyone watched her stepping out of the car and onto the porch. Everyone watched her answer the phone, turning pale as the moon. She closed the lid. Everyone gathered as Albert shut off the car and looked into her eyes like they would tell the future. Sarah the Blade spoke. James from the lake jumped off the 417 bridge, flowing into the flowing river below, like a swan going under for food. He never came back up. They said he broke all his bones from the fall, and he couldn't swim to shore. He is gone for good. James from the lake, born into the world by his mother on her 18th birthday. His father, a nomad like the drifters in olden days, worked every job he could keep. James met his father when he worked in the fields, but now he would see him no more. The sorrow too overwhelming, each passed the afternoon, drifting on the wind as the sun passed from low to high on the horizon. Mikey the Foot thrashed the air in the yard at the loss, as from the forest line the dark hairy beast crawled from like a swerving shadow. Mikey the Foot slammed his foot onto the earth as dust rose and the house shook. The dark figure revealed its true form, the North American black bear. Mikey ran halfway to meet the mystic giant, where each showed their jagged teeth. Mikey's forearms big as semis, while the black arm of the bear retracted long claws. The bear took the first blow to the snout as Mikey dripped backwards. He pushed the mystic giant off while it flew a quick left hook. With Mikey the Foot dazed, the black bear held Mikey up in the air with two paws circling on hind legs like a wrestler with canine teeth. But then Mikey the Foot twisted at the top, falling to the grass below, where he kicked the leg out from the bear. He struck the heart with closed fist. Like a ringing alarm, the bear hollered in defeat and retreated to the dim forest. A bald eagle circled above, watching in silence. She drove into the hillside to meet Danielle the cartoons. The talons gripped her ponytail and carried her 9 miles west.
Thank you.
Two pages.
Thank you.
It wouldn't have bothered me if you went 2 more pages, my man. This is the grand finale, and you know what? What's nice about poetry is all the poets here, there's some that read everybody I like. Everybody's taking their heart and they're putting it out here. And I remember the first time, and I'm telling you, I've testified on homicide cases, and it's harder sometimes to get up here. So let's hear it for that last part, my man. Petey, where are you going to get up here? Come on up here, my buddy.
I just got one poem. It's called Poem for the Movie Notorious. It's an Alfred Hitchcock film. You guys, I think everyone who nodded got it. Everyone who didn't nod, that's fine. I'm hovering over your bedside, Ingrid Bergman, who is poisoned traumatically by her fake husband, who doesn't know that he's fake. Just the audio and a little box in the corner of my screen for the film which I've downloaded without the visuals by mistake. Seems appropriate for the romance coming out of the tubes into my living room combination kitchen, where I'm cooking bacon, all alone, hoping my roommate isn't home. Death and mother and lover keep circulating through my mind in the form of words, along with the law, and in honesty, which I have yet to determine how it is supposed to guide my life, for so how completely I surrender to it. Steer the prow with sunken warrior eyes I inherit from my father, trying to keep afloat on a bed of a couple hundred in a savings account, and the promise I can always return home. Love, like a drain I'm spitting in. All right, thanks.
Mary Lee, come on up here. Mary Soon Lee, come on.
That looks about right. Okay. I'm going to read a poem which appeared in Crowned, which is a book of epic fantasy. And it is one poem, but it is two sides, Joan. No, we'll read one. The Matter of the Horses. General Qiang stood in King Cao's tent with the king's other generals and the king's advisors and the king's guards and the king's serving boy and the king himself, the tent crowded with men, rank with sweat. The young king sat on a stool, his left arm in a sling, a grimness about him that matched Qiang's own mood, though the war was over, the victory theirs, the king's advisors jubilant. Qiang hadn't slept last night, had tried to sleep, failed. Yesterday's battle still with him, the horses, mud, rain, blood. In the tent, the talk moved to the matter of the horses, to how it could be exploited for conquest. No, said the king, one word enough to quiet the tent. We do not crave conquest. Even so, said an adviser, we should test the limits of your control over the horses, the better to employ it for defense. The adviser turned to Qiang. General, how would you proceed? Qiang looked at the adviser, a man who had never fought a single battle, who'd sheltered in a tent yesterday, warm and dry, while rain cascaded from Qiang's saddle, his armor, turning earth and horse shit to stinking mud, Qiang riding on the king's right, the king injured, unable to hold a shield, but still riding, Qiang's horse maneuvering beneath him before he even gave the commands, all the horses in perfect unison, as if they were 1,000 shadows of a single, faultless form. A thing out of legend, out of the old times, when dragons flew to King Nariz and demons walked the earth. The stench, the pounding of hooves of Qiang's pulse as he rode beside the king, as the enemy charged full at them and stopped. Every horse in the Red King's army rooted to the spot, though their riders kicked them. Whereupon the Red King, red-haired and red-handed in war, screamed in his barbarous language, and then the enemy had slaughtered their own horses, slitting their necks, the horses floundering in blood. Qiang looked at the advisor and said, if it were my decision, I wouldn't test the horses, I would let them be. Even if inaction now leads to defeat later. Even then. Into the stretching silence, the king spoke. What happened with the horses is not a trick to practice and parade, but a gift the horses gave, a gift for which many of them died. The king's gaze rested on Qiang, anchoring him. Qiang touched his hand to his heart, offered it palm up to the king, a gesture Qiang had never made before, the sign of allegiance of warriors in the old tales. The tent crowded with men, but for that moment, only the two of them. Thank you, Jimmy and Joan.
And Don.
And Don.
Did we miss any poets? Did you want to read something tonight? Didn't bring anybody else. Yinzers, you want to read any more poems? Hey, no, come here, Wazzo. Kid Wazzo, come here. You, come here. Yo, come here. Read one more of your poem for me, would you? Yeah, right here.
Johnny Moore.
Okay. I just wanted to drink and smoke cigarettes, but now I'm up here again. Yeah, that's it. All right. This one's for you, Jim. It's called The Bank Lady. Wait, let me start over. I was not prepared to do this, you see. Okay. I went to my bank, which is in a grocery store. I told the woman, I want to check my balance. She said, you know, you can do that online or on the phone. I said, yeah, but, you know, I wanted to talk to someone, and it's Tuesday. Everyone else is working. Last time I was here, you gave me this sexy, bitchy face, and I wanted to see it again. She said, you have $43. Fuck, I said. She said, it's all virtual reality anyway. I mean, what is it? Just numbers in your dumb account? Your account is even virtual reality. It just exists in this fucking screen. What do you need to buy anyway? And I said, well, I gotta pay bills, I said. She sticks out her tongue and says, blah, blah, bills, blah, blah, bills. Isn't this shit getting boring? What, I said. She said, everything. Everything should just go to hell. We should just live in the woods. Let more than half of the population die off and just start fucking and fucking and start a brand new world. We'll come back to technology when we're ready for it. You know, this morning I woke up dreading to come to work. I mean, just the idea of it. Crawling out of bed and fighting through horrible temperatures and weather and traffic to stand next to this boring fuck here, and she points to the guy next to her, and do this, and she mimics typing on a computer, making dumb faces. But I also dread the weekend, just getting drunk or fucked and watching Netflix. And it's not hard, don't get me wrong, I could have it much worse. And I say, yeah, yeah, I said, that's true, we're all lucky. Then I bought a pack of cigarettes and 6 pounds of werewolf meat. In my head, I calculate my account is down to $33. That's it.